Good evening, everyone. And let's see. So, I'd like to encourage people to sit closer together. I don't think that we're particularly more people today than usual, but somehow we're not as efficiently situated. So there were people sitting out in the hallway today. And also, the chairs are kind of empty over here. So we don't have to do it, I don't know if you need to do it now anymore, but... maybe remember the next times, kind of come forward and kind of sit a little bit tighter up together and tend to try to fill, if it's possible, try to fill the seats up here before filling the seats in the back. So people who come late, it's easier for them to find a place to sit. And also, when we're kind of this full, maybe I was thinking that maybe it works as a very gentle reminder or suggestion for people to come on time, so you find a place. And I don't know what. You know what's happening, but it felt more restless here today than it has in a long time. So I don't know whether it's the time of year or the weather or us or all of it. So I don't know how receptive you were for that receptive exercise. But I would like to hear from some of you. Does anyone have anything you want to say? Was that interesting to do, or did that change anything for you, or? Yes.
Well, I couldn't remember being outside and being relaxed. I mean, I know all the times I remember being outside, I seem to be sort of agitated in some way. So I sort of, I finally settled on sitting inside and after being very doing lots of exercise and everything. Coming home and drinking coffee.
Oh, great. And so what happened then when you let go of that memory and I just sat then in that kind of mode, how was that?
It didn't seem so different from before.
Good. So a good homework for you is to go out, and you go out in nature this next week and with your coffee. Yes.
When you mention relaxing the eyes, the whole body relaxes. That's very powerful.
There's a lot that gets held in the eyes. Oh, so much. Yes.
I liked how you reminded us not to make anything special of it.
I was getting restless toward the end of the sitting, but once you started leading us into the guided meditation, all of a sudden everything became, like, I was much more aware, and everything was just much more interesting and energetic.
Nice. And what was it like for some of you to open your eyes? Could you stay a little bit in that receptive mode? Elaine says, no way. What is this a little bit too loud, the speaker today? Was it just right? Okay. Yes. So what? Why not?
Well, I missed a little bit and looked down the floor, and it was just the color and the light coming in. It was just a shock. And then, so I shut them again. Okay, get back to relaxation. It was feeling pretty foamy. Open them more and saw all these people. I thought, oh, there's no way that could stay the
same. This is
just what put us at that.
Someone else? Yes.
To me, what's amazing when we sit here in a room together is that occasionally I'll hear the person next to me breathing, but I have no idea how many people there are here. And yeah, it's really powerful to be sitting in a group. And then when I open my eyes,
yeah, I'm often surprised too. I sometimes sit down and close my eyes before many people are here, and I don't hear a lot of people coming in. And then at some point I open my eyes to look at the watch or something, and I'm kind of taken back by where do they all come from. But I'd like to point out that some of you, I'm sure, have heard this from me many times, that some of the insight or wisdom that's possible through mindfulness meditation or meditation at all occurs not in meditation, not kind of the process of getting yourself settled in the meditative mode, but rather it's when coming out of meditation or leaving a longer retreat or retreat. Because in some sense, what happens when you meditate, perhaps, is that we kind of relax some of the normal ways in which we construct ourselves and construct our reality. Which takes a lot of work and effort to construct it, and all our fears and anxieties and whatever, and all our stories. And then if you pay very careful attention to what it's like when you come out of meditation or you leave a retreat, you might start noticing how you start reconstructing your normal way of being, a normal way of seeing the world around you. And I know for many people the tendency is, you know, the bell rings at the end of the sitting and that's it. You know, it's vacation time, or you know, you've done your duty for the day, and so you can just rush off to the next thing. But it's very interesting to take some time to come out of your meditation slowly, and it's very interesting to do this thing with the eyes, is because the eyes are so packed full of maybe psychological significance for us. There's so much holding in the eyes that can happen. That if you things get complicated very quickly when we have sight, so all these stories. And if you take and open your eyes and see if you can be in the same receptive, open mode with receiving sights as maybe you were with receiving sensations of the breath, breathing, or sensations of the body, or sounds coming. If you can kind of try to keep that with your eyes, then you're much more likely to begin catching or seeing when we start grabbing hold or constructing some kind of new reality or sense of self for ourselves, or concerns about preoccupations or whatever it might be. Because so much happens around seeing. And then the other place to do it is around speaking. So if you come out of meditation or come out of retreat, or notice what happens around the first speech act afterwards. That gets even more complicated than what happens when we start seeing. And you can start noticing many of the kind of motivations and concerns and preoccupations that goes into speaking. And I did that for a long time. Each morning I would try to catch and be mindful for each time that I spoke. The first time I spoke after the meditation. And some days, you know, I would notice in the afternoon that I've been speaking all day. But some days I was able to catch that first speech act, and it was very powerful. And for me, I learned a lot about how I function in the world, how I project on the world or participate in the world, by noticing the difference between the way that I sit in meditation or the way I sit under an oak tree and just kind of look out across the hillsides. You're grimacing.
The sound is so ugly.
I thought it was kind of... Let me turn it down a little bit, maybe. Is it that... Let's see.
A human voice is such a nice thing. It seems a pity to spoil.
Well, thank you. But I think that people need to... What? That's better? I think it was too loud.
It reverberates somehow. There's some places in the room that are better for the sound than other places. Something happens.
Those speakers have a volume thing that
may
turn it down.
Rob's looking at it now.
Yeah. Isn't it reasonable that the hearing impaired aids?
Well, it's okay. We'll figure out some way to make it everybody work for everybody. And you know, my voice tends to be so low, and sometimes it gets lower and lower, so that people don't feel like they're hearing impaired. So they feel maybe like I'm speaking impaired or something.
I think that acoustic dynamics are one of the most fascinating things about public speech.
I should learn some.
And I noticed I'm really focused. And it worked very well, and then you slowly came up.
But the frustration level over the months raised until this happened. So I don't know, we can experiment with not having it again sometimes and going back and forth. But I was asked many times to speak louder, and it was really hard for me. And when I was actually succeeding in speaking louder, I didn't like speaking. And I think I should feel comfortable when I'm speaking, shouldn't I? So we got the speaker. So let's see. Is this better now?
Yeah.
And people in the back can still hear, right? Just what we need is just a little bit with people in the back. And I think the ideal thing would be just the back kind of two rows got the amplification and the rest of the people didn't. And one possibility is maybe only keeping one of the speakers on. I don't know. No? Okay. So the mode of receptive awareness that sometimes we can experience in meditation is a very interesting mode of being, way of being, which then you can use that as a contrast in your daily life to when you're not in that particular mode. And now it's acting up a little bit. And I learned, again, a lot about it. And one of the things I learned was, after a while, what I started paying attention to was when I was talking with people, kind of one-on-one, which is relatively, for me, and I think for most people, complicated event, besides just what's being the content going back and forth. There's all the emotions and feelings and projections and concerns and worries and anxieties and anticipations. And, you know, there's a number of things going on there when you speak with someone. And what I did, what I started doing when I spoke with people, I would remember what it was like to sit in meditation where I felt very centered and grounded without all those kind of preoccupations, and I felt very much at ease. Or you can maybe, you know, when you're at, you know, sitting at the beach looking at the ocean, and you're not concerned about all you know, your story and how you are and who they are and all these things. And I started contrasting that when I spoke with people with that state earlier. And using that as a contrast, I was able then to see much more clearly all the stuff that, not all, but many of the stuff that felt extra that went into the conversation, that went from my part. And I could see that extra stuff, and some of it then I could see was optional, and I could drop it, or some of it I could drop, and I could be there in a much more receptive way with that person. And sometimes, you know, it became kind of a practice of, in its own right, like a meditation practice in its own right, listening to people, talking to people. It's a lot easier listening than talking for me. But listening to people in that kind of mode. But if I can get into it properly, kind of just allowing the whole situation to be there with no real distinction between inside and outside, no real distinction about whether the person's there or not in some kind of way, just I'm just present and aware, then I find that often some kind of response arises within me to speak back to that person. That seems often quite appropriate, but I can't really, sometimes I can't even say that I'm the one who's speaking almost. Of course I am. But it's just kind of coming out of the situation rather than me kind of concerned and worrying about what to say next and all these things. So this state of receptive awareness is very relaxed. It's a very nice thing to have. But it's also nice to use that as, even in memory of that, as a way of highlighting or understanding the rest of our life, what goes on and how we participate in it. And this, the receptive awareness that is the capacity of all of us, is always accessible, I think. It's always kind of part of who we are. And what's interesting is that we have such a strong tendency to dichotomize our world between many kind of dualities or dichotomies. And but one of them is between the idea of the perceived, what's perceived, and the perceiver. And what there is there's this awareness that's going on. And the awareness kind of registers and is aware of what's going on. But because we have a very strong sense of self, or idea that there has to be a self, we often attach that sense of awareness or that perception with the notion that there's a perceiver, that there's someone who's aware. And from that then follows a whole bunch of other stuff. It's like the cornerstone of a huge edifice which gets built on top of that cornerstone. And one of the first cornerstones is the idea that there's a perceiver who's perceiving what's going on. And most of us will think, well, it's pretty common sense that there's a perceiver perceiving what's going on. But what there is in the kind of raw experience, there's simply perception of what's happening. But we're very quickly tend to divide into subject and object, a subjective perceiver, experiencer, and the objective experience. There's also the distinction between a doer and the action. You know, that I'm the doer and I'm doing something. So I'm speaking and they're speaking and I'm the speaker, rather than just their speaking happening. I'm going to add this other piece that I am speaking. And when I'm in this very receptive mode, which happens occasionally, and I can speak from that, it seems extra to have the kind of self-reflective analysis that I am speaking. That kind of self-reflective analysis doesn't really come out of that way of speaking. It's just speaking is happening. And so we tend to categorize or divide our experience between someone experiencing and the experience itself. And as soon as you have a perceiver, then you have kind of a self. And as soon as you have a self, then that idea or notion or concept of self is like, I don't know, like a magnet perhaps for all kinds of culturally conditioned ideas of what a self should be like. The idea, just a raw experience of perceiving, even if you add the perceiver to the perceiving, if you kind of pay careful attention to what that actual perception is, that perceiver is, it's a very kind of simple, almost translucent, transparent experience. However, as soon as we have this notion of self, we tend to add all these ideas of what a self is supposed to be like in our culture. You're supposed to be, I mean, you can fill it in for yourself, but fill in the blanks. But I wanted to tell you about a professor in Berkeley, in the psychology department there, who, I didn't read his study, but I read about it. And as I understand it, he studied elderly people. And he wanted to study how their personality traits or qualities or whatever, the traits, changed over time. And he took two groups of elderly people. Elderly people who were sick a lot, or relatively sick or ill, and elderly people who were relatively healthy. And I think what he did was he asked them kind of to measure them for themselves how their personality traits were changing over time. And so they all had reports, different. And the people who were sick reported many more personality changes over time than the people who were relatively healthy. However, both of them reported personality changes over time. But both groups reported that personality changed for the worse over time. So that's kind of interesting. But then you find out what qualities, what personality qualities are they measuring themselves by, their personality. And so the things that were important for them was activity, doing, power, dominance, acquisition, competence, and achieving. So if their sense of personality, you know, if those things are important qualities, then as you get older, watch out. You might not be quite as happy. So I don't know, you know, what else was going on in this study, but I think we all internalize from our society ideas of what it means to be a successful person or a worthy person. And there's a lot of focus in America on achieving and doing things. And the idea of being eternally young, of course, is kind of well known. And so people, when they get older, look back at them, kind of compare themselves when they were 30 or 40 or 20, and kind of say, well, you know, I can't play tennis as many times of the week, and therefore I'm not as worthy or not as good or whatever. My teacher in Burma, Upandita, he was very fond of saying, well, he said this because it was really, really, for our health, it was very difficult to be in Burma. And we were all getting sick all the time. Now, very sick. And so people would come and complain about this and that to him, and there was nothing much he can do except, the monastery did the best they could. They got the best doctors in Burma to come and see us, literally. They did, you know, the whole country kind of took care of our health. But so it wasn't a lack of effort on people's part, but still, you know. But a lot of these sicknesses were kind of imaginary. I mean, you know, it's really hot and sweaty and muggy, you know, and you're sitting there in all this hot and heat and everything, sitting there for hour and hour, hour after hour, for day after day after day. And then, you know, a single kind of varicose vein, kind of little teeny one, pops up on your leg. Freak out time. You know, oh my God, you know, I must be killing myself here. And so you go, the people go to the teacher and complain, you know, about how terrible it was, you know, they got this little varicose vein popping. Anyway, what he was fond of saying was, as you get older, the body begins to kind of fall apart. But if you practice, your mind, you say it this beautiful, kind of inspired way, you say, your mind would only get sharper. And for him, what had value or purpose for him was kind of an alertness or sharpness of mind, which in his experience, and he was quite an old man, was getting sharper and sharper as he got older. And even though his body was definitely falling apart, I think he had diabetes and various things, difficulties. And I think it's interesting, I think it's very important actually to reflect a little bit about what senses of self we have acquired from a culture around us which teach us and tell us that we're successful, good, worthy people. And how reasonable are these judgments, and how sustainable are these judgments as we continue through life. And you know, some people, you know, there's many stories to be said around this idea. You know, and what occurs to me now is the story of people who retire, and soon after they retire, they die. Some people retire and they get well. But it all depends, you know, it depends a lot on. So, but some people who die, sometimes after they retire, the idea I've heard is that their whole sense of worth and sense of being and sense of motivation for life was tied into working. And it's very difficult for some people to stop working and still maintain a sense of worthiness in themselves, because their sense of worth was tied into success and achievement and production at work. So then we have a sense of self. And that sense of self then we kind of as a magnet for these ideas of what's worthy, what's good, what that sense of self requires from the world around it, from itself, and all these things. And it's very interesting to study how certain emotions arise indirectly from the notion or idea of self that we've created for ourselves. So, for example, if we get angry, our sense of self is being threatened. And sometimes what's being threatened is completely silly, as some of us, all of us probably know sometimes. So we look back now at what we were like as teenagers, for example. Or, you know, you look back in time, it's a lot less threatening to look at yourself. And then guilt. guilt sometimes arises when our notion of self is bad or is wrong. Anger was a sense of being. So fear is when the self is threatened, and anger sometimes when the self is hurt. Ambition, when we want to enhance this idea we have of the self. We want to, you know, have that better three-piece suit. You know, ambitious, we want to make more money so we can get a three-piece suit, or so we can drive that Lexus or whatever. Boredom sometimes arises also in relationship to the idea we have of what it means to have a self, to support or enhance a sense of self. And if things in the environment support that sense of self, we're kind of galvanized and excited, you know, praise someone and suddenly you have their attention. Or if our sense of self is threatened, criticize someone and you'll have their attention too. But if the situation is kind of basically boring in relationship, or the situation doesn't support or threaten this idea of self, then sometimes the reaction for some people is boredom. And they're bored with the people they're with, they're bored with the situation or whatever. So the sense of self often becomes the nucleus of all this, in a sense, is the idea that we're a perceiver, that there is an agent here for our doing and for our seeing and everything. And then we add to this idea of an agent various ideas of what this agent is supposed to be like. And a lot of that is adapted from our culture. And one of the really fascinating things to do is to study the anthropology of personality, the anthropology of basic human behavior, anthropology of emotions, because they're so culturally conditioned. And things that we take so much for granted are just our particular cultural way of doing it. And you can read books on a culturally conditioned nature of our sexuality. And our sexuality, and we think that's kind of basic, kind of raw, kind of impulsive kind of stuff, right? And it's one of the most culturally packed, charged things going on, is our sexuality and our relationship to others. It's not this simple kind of basic biological thing. And I think it's really the anthropologists, more than anyone else perhaps, maybe psychologists, who have begun taking apart the cultural conditioning, and we're seeing it. And we don't see that we're living in the ocean of culturally conditioned ideas that we take it for granted. So the story that occurs to me that I like to tell around this is, I think it was either anthropologists or psychologists noticed that during or after World War II, there were all these American GIs stationed in England. And the GIs would say, these English women, they're so promiscuous, they're so aggressive sexually. And then the English women would say, these American soldiers, they're so promiscuous, they're so sexually aggressive. So this seemed very strange to the people who are studying this, that they both had these kind of complaining about each other being that way. So they studied how courtship happened in England and in America. And they found out that there were 12 steps to courtship, or something, or 15 steps, in both cultures. But in American culture, kissing was like step number 3. And going to bed and having intercourse was like step number 12 or 15, or the very end, the top of it, you know, the last thing you did before you got married. Or whatever. In 1940. Or maybe afterwards, yeah, I don't know. But the important thing is kissing happened very early, and there are all these steps between kissing and going to bed together. And but in England, kissing happened like step number 11 or 13 or 14. It was very late in the courtship process. And it happened so late, it happened actually just before a couple would go to bed together. So an American, you know, GI would kiss an English date. And the English woman would be confused. Or the English woman would interpret that and saying, oh my God, if I'm serious about this guy, I better get serious now. Or leave. So then they get serious, thinking that's what it was called for. And these American men, we get confused then. Because this is way ahead of schedule. So So here's an example of, you know, kind of example of how cultures, you know, have different ways of understanding similar situations and they're conditioned. And sometimes we take it for granted that, you know, kissing should happen in step number three or whatever. Some of us, I guess. This is another psychologist from UC Berkeley. This woman, Eleanor Rauch, studies Buddhist psychology in the psychology department there. And she writes this: "Some years ago, I was questioned by a visiting Tibetan monk about how psychology was studied in the West. Carefully, I tried to delineate our fields of psychology: cognition with its sub-areas such as attention and memory, personality psychology, developmental, and so forth. He looked puzzled. I attempted to explain what we meant by empirical method. He seemed even more puzzled. I talked about operational definitions and described some psychological experiments. Suddenly, his look of intensely interested bewilderment turned to one of, aha. So you are saying that in America, people teach and write about psychology who have no meditation practice? Yes, of course. But then, how can they know anything? And then, giving me a piercing look, do you think that's ethical? So we have this ability to be aware. And it's really kind of a wonderful capacity of our mind. I mean, our mind is really a fantastic thing, the brain, the mind, consciousness, awareness. And we can, I'm in awe at the powers and its abilities to reflect and to think and to be creative. And it's just really amazing. But because of all its power and creativity, it can use that sometimes to get us into big-time trouble. And we creatively construct this huge sense of self, and then we'll defend it at all costs. But what is the mind? What is awareness and what is consciousness? And it's kind of like the ocean we swim in, our awareness. It's like the ocean we swim in, and we don't even see the ocean we swim in. We tend to be so caught up in the content of what we see, content of our awareness, the stories, the ideas, the external situations, our emotions, our feelings, the things that we can perceive, but the actual act of perception itself, the act of awareness, which is always there, is like the other half of the equation. It often goes unstudied and unaware to any of us, to many of us. And one of the things we can do in meditation is to kind of relax a little bit and rest or find the receptive mode of being, receptive awareness, that has to be there for us to experience anything. So we have what's called in Buddhism, and I think not just in Buddhism, I guess, but in probably almost all meditative traditions, the idea of witnessing consciousness, of witnessing our experience. And I say, use the word witnessing carefully so as not to add the idea of being a witness. But people often have the experience when they do mindfulness meditation after a while of developing a stronger sense of being a witness or being a witness or of witnessing their experience. And I think that's often quite appropriate. It's a normal part, witnessing, being aware of what's going on is a normal part of human consciousness. And so we start witnessing and becoming aware of what's going on. And for many people, when they start being aware, being a witness carefully to what's happening in their life, especially their inner life, it can, as many of you I think know, comes as a great shock and a surprise. And for some people, I've had people come to me and say something like the equivalent of, oh my God, I'm such an egomaniac. And they start noticing that all their thoughts and ideas seem to center on themselves and how they're relating to everything and how everything relates to them and their fears and their ideas and their judgments and their categories of people they put in. And, you know, everything seems to be so self-centered. And it can be such a shock. Or if it's not self-centered, then people notice what's sometimes called the monkey mind. or in India, sometimes called the elephant, just kind of running berserk, kind of all over the forest. And this, you know, this, you know, what we start noticing, this monkey mind, is we start noticing when this huge edifice of ideas and reality construction we've created, we start noticing how it all works and how complicated it is and sometimes how out of control it might be. And what happens to a lot of people is they live their life in these quite abstract worlds of ideas of who they are and who other people are and what the relationship is between people. And they have very little contact with reality directly. And what witnessing or what mindfulness is trying to help us do is to help us have a direct experience with what's happening, a kind of direct, undistracted experience of what's happening, and not to be lost in the abstractions. Because when we're lost in abstractions, we're separated from our direct experience. And when we're separated from a direct experience, we're separated from others, and we're separated from ourselves also. And it can be very lonely. And a lot of people come and talk to me about the isolation and loneliness they feel. Just feel. And often, when people talk about being lonely, or being kind of not having a lot of friends, or being very lonely or isolated from others, it doesn't take very long, kind of, to ask some questions to find out that they're also separated or alienated from themselves. And these things are often quite closely related. Because if you live in a world of abstractions, then you're not really living in your own experience, and then you're separated from yourself, and you're separated from others. So we begin developing this witness, developing this mindfulness of what's happening right now, what's going on. And I think this sense of being of witnessing is the foundation of much Buddhist practice. And then, but at some point, the idea of the sense of a witness and a witnesser can dissolve or dissolves. And we awaken them to kind of non-dualistic awareness, where people often have the feeling that there's no distinction anymore, a sharp distinction between inside and outside. There's simply just awareness and experiences happening within awareness. There's no perceiver, no awareer, nothing. It isn't that we're witnessing reality at this point, but rather that we are reality, we've become reality. And so we often make this very sharp distinction or boundary between us experiencing reality and reality out there. And actually it's a dance, it's inseparable from each other. And I think many spiritual practices, traditions, have tricks or practices or whatever, skillful means to help us dissolve a sharp distinction between experience and a perceiver, between a perception and perceiver. So we can kind of rest in the kind of receptive awareness that I was suggesting at the beginning of today, this evening. But for many people, because the monkey mind is so strong, for many people, what they first need to develop is their attention itself. They need to develop a stronger level of attention, perhaps a stronger witnessing mode. Part of mindfulness is in training one's attention. So it's not constantly being pulled away, constantly being lost in the edifice that the monkey has created. And once the attention is developed strong enough, it doesn't have to be developed that strong. I like to say that the amount of concentration you need for Buddhist spiritual life or for meditative life is the amount of concentration you need to take the written exam in the DMV. So that we all, you know, that's it. It doesn't take much. But, you know, we're there, we're really motivated. And so we're really engaged, right? But, no? You weren't? Oh, some people aren't. I used to love taking exams in school because I would get so concentrated. Anyway. I think that's getting to be enough. I'd like to read. I'll just read two things. And I don't know if they, how well they follow from any of this, but I don't know if anything follows from anything tonight. This is a friend of mine wrote this poem. Her name is Wendy Lewis. And her poem says, "It is like this. There is this bird, and you catch it in your hands. You feel its softness, warmth, its heart rapidly beating. But if you keep holding it, it's no longer a bird. So you open your hands, catch it, and let it go again and again. But if you keep holding it, it's no longer a bird. So you open your hands and let it go." And I think that's a lot of what we learn to do in practice, is not so much abandon the world of abstractions or ideas or even the world of self, and but rather we learn to hold ourselves and hold our life kind of softly, the way soft, kind of gentle way you'd hold maybe a baby bird that had fallen from its nest and you picked it up to put it back. Or you hold a bird. But you don't want to hold it so tight that you kill it. But you can't keep holding it. If you keep holding it, it's not a bird. It's, you know, it can't be a bird. And if you keep holding yourself in some tight constriction of what it means to be a self, you're not a self. It's kind of a wonderful paradox. So it was Jesus or someone said, you have to die in order to live. I don't know if that follows at all, but I don't know where that came from. See, sometimes when you just kind of talk, you know, from... See, sometimes it just comes wonderful, just really appropriate. And sometimes you don't know where it comes from. So take that as a warning. But at least I'm relaxed. Oh, I wanted to say that for a while I used to have trouble in writing distinguishing my writing between the word release and realize, because they're kind of spelled almost the same if you kind of move some vowels around. And release and realize, and we talk about realization, making real, and to release. And I think maybe they're closely related. Realization involves a kind of release. We train our attention and then we release it. Hanshan, the great and crazy, wonder-filled Chinese poet of 1,000 years ago, said, "We're just like bugs in a bowl, all day going around, never leaving their bowl." I say, "That's right. Every day, climbing up the steep sides, sliding back, over and over again, around and around, up and back down. Sit in the bottom of the bowl, head in your hands, cry, moan, feel sorry for yourself. Or, look around, see your fellow bugs, walk around, say, 'Hey, how you doing?'" "Say, nice bowl." But first you have to find the bowl. And one bowl is our awareness. So enjoy your awareness. And people have been searching for the mind and consciousness for thousands of years. And no one seems to ever have figured out what it is. Though you read lots of books that tell you what it is. But all the different books disagree. Anyway, but it's worth checking it out, finding out for yourself. So thank you all. Good night. Are there some new newsletters for this coming few months? with our next upcoming events for those of you who want.
I kind of forgot.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't forget, but I got kind of.
Do a quick check with you. Just, are you your? If I want to talk to Rich.